Okay, great, thanks. So first I have to apologize. I'm recovering from a cold and my voice is a little bit deeper than it usually is. So I don't think the ultra faints need much of an introduction. This talk is going to be essentially in three parts, and this is part one. I will be focusing primarily on the observations of the ultra faints in terms of how these objects were actually found, and then talking about observations of the velocities, the kinematics, and the mass. Talk about how we are measuring the masses and how we could have gotten these masses wrong, namely focusing on sort of looking at evidence for tidal interactions and tidal disruption. Part two is going to come after the coffee. Josh Simon is going to be discussing observations of the Deimos mid-resolution spectroscopy looking at abundances, as well as a lot of observations high resolution looking at various different element abundances in a fair number of the ultrafaints. And then part three, essentially part three, is going to come tomorrow. James Bullock is going to be looking at this from more theoretical perspective, talking about the missing satellites and indirect detection of dark matter in these objects. And my collaborators also come in three parts. Josh Simon and Beth Willman are sort of on the observational side, doing the observations and the kinematics. Evan Kirby and Anna Frevel have really been looking at the chemistries and the abundances. And then Louis Strigari, James Bullock, and Joe Wolf are coming at this from a theoretical perspective, been doing a lot of the mass modeling. I just want to highlight Joe Wolf for a second. He's a first-year graduate student at UC Irvine and has been making a lot of the plots that I'll be showing in this talk. And it's been great this week. We've just been saying, all these issues are coming up. We say, Joe, can you go plot this? Joe, can you go plot that? So I really appreciate the work he's been doing this week. So we've seen this plot before. This is the new objects and the old objects. The old classical dwarfs are plotted in blue, where I guess we use the word classical because if you called them old dwarfs, you might mix this up with age. The new ones are plotted in red, and just listing them as a function of their discovery date. I mean, just looking at the discovery dates, you might say that there was sort of a recession in the industry of dwarf galaxy finding in the sort of beginning in the 60s up through the last last couple of years. The three galaxies, Carina, Sextans, and Sagittarius, that were found 70 and then in the 90s, are all in sort of strange places in the sky where the background was really quite high. But those objects are all sort of in the classical dwarfs. They have higher surface brightnesses. And the new objects beginning in 2005 really are different. They have much different surface brightnesses and lie in a little bit different region of parameter space. But let's, yeah. I will leave that to the astroarchaeologists. Let's just talk about the numbers because I actually have a difficulty keeping these in my head. Things are moving quite fast. So the classical dwarf satellites, there were 11 known up before 2005. The ultrafaint dwarf spheroidals are now numbering 13. There's two objects that may or may not, should or should not be added, included in this list. Leo 5 was just recently discovered. There's only a couple of stars that have velocities, and it looks like this might be, I think there's evidence that this might be a tidal debris or something like that rather than a dwarf, but the jury is certainly still out on that. Willman 1, sort of the original object that was discovered, also we have some questions about it. And my last slide, I'll show the velocity data that we have for Willman 1, and it's a little bit of a murky situation. I'll go over that. But the rest of these things really seem to be dwarf spheroidals. And so clearly the gray area is the Sloan-Digital Sky Survey in which all of the new objects have been found so far. Clearly we expect to find more as we search the rest of the sky, so we can just talk about the numbers we might expect in the future. Sorry, so if you add those up, right now the Milky Way has 24 satellites. If we were to search the SDSS sky to Sloan depths, and just assuming that things are the same in the rest of the sky as where we've already searched, you would expect the Sloan has searched roughly a fourth of the sky, a little bit more than that. You would expect perhaps about 60 galaxies, 60 dwarf spheroidals, to the depths of Sloan. But clearly there's a second incompleteness here in that the faintest objects that we've found so far, the least luminous, we can only find out to certain distances. And so if we assume a very generous, if we could find all objects all the way out to about 400 kiloparsecs and that those are, we see those in the same volume as we do locally, we'd expect something like 400 Milky Way dwarfs, maybe even a little bit more. There's a poster by Eric Tullerud out in the coffee room. James Bullock will talk about this in a little bit more detail. Clearly, this has a lot, a big influence on the missing satellite problems and those sorts of things, but I'll leave it to James to talk about that in more detail. So again, we've seen sort of this image before. Why were the new satellites missed? And again, this is just an issue of surface brightness. The newest dwarfs have luminosities essentially of globular clusters, but you take that globular cluster and you stretch it out over a much larger radius and you get a much lower luminosity. And so for the old objects, clearly you can draw a circle around that and say that's a dwarf. For the new ones, it's a lot more difficult. And so to answer the question of why these things were missed, you really have to answer how these objects were actually found. I think it's illustrative to go through how these objects were found and sort of understand what part of parameter space was searched to find these objects and what part of parameter space has not yet been searched in terms of these objects. So again, these objects, we don't see them because the background is too high. And this is sort of analogous to trying to see stars during the daytime. The background is simply too high. You have to get rid of the background, wait until nighttime to actually see stars. The same is true for these ultrafaints. And so there is a galaxy sitting right in the center of this image, but you don't see it. The people in the back might say, well, it's kind of, I can't really see the image anyway, or maybe the stretch is wrong. And so if you just, replace this by each star by dots, again, you still don't see anything. And the reason is that the background is too high. And I have background in quotes because really it's the foreground. The foreground of Milky Way stars in front of us is too high to actually see this object. And so the philosophy in finding these new objects is that we need to filter the star count maps by assuming some sort of set of dwarf galaxy properties in order to be able to see the new objects. And so this is work has been was pioneered by Beth Willman and has been taken on by Vasily Bolokhorov, but I'm going to focus on the most recent paper giving the providing candidates from the SDSS, which is Shane Walsh and Beth Lohman's work. And what they do is assume that a dwarf galaxy, a dwarf spheroidal, is an old metal poor population sitting at a certain distance. And so here, the definition of old and metal poor is somewhat generous. And here I'm plotting a color matrix diagram showing the isochrones. Sort of the range of isochrones you would expect in an old metal poor population. So old meaning sort of 8 to 14 gigayears and metallicities between -1 and -2.3. We would go to lower metallicities, but there are no theoretical isochrones at lower metallicities, which is kind of an interesting problem. So here is the range, in this gray shaded region, is if you were a star in this old metal poor population, this is where you would sit in color magnitude diagram space. In this case, just assuming a distance of 20 kiloparsecs, but you can imagine just sliding this filter down as you go to larger distances to try and find these objects. The Sloan magnitude limit is right here, is at 22 magnitudes in R. And so you can see as you slide this filter down, you quickly, going out to about 40 or 50 kiloparsecs, would lose the main sequence turnoff. And for these faintest objects that really don't have that many stars, luminosities of 1,000 total solar luminosities or less, you really need to look all the way down below the main sequence turnoff just to have enough stars to see any sort of signal. And about half of the objects you really are faint enough, so you have to, half the objects found so far, you need to get down to the main sequence turnoff. The other half of the newest objects are found at larger distances that have enough stars that you see a red giant branch and a horizontal branch. And so there's really like this two-tiered system where the faintest ones you need to get to lower magnitude or fainter magnitude limits to really be able to see. And so now you can imagine taking this filter and looking all around the sky and at various distances trying to find stellar overdensities. So doing that in this image, taking all stars and now applying that filter, you still probably don't see anything obvious, but you can start. Your mind can start to sort of make patterns in these stars. The next step is to smooth this and try and find overdensities. And so here's the second choice that you need to make in terms of what length, over which length, over what radius do you smooth the star count map, and that's giving you a certain size of galaxies that you're going to find. And so in this case, this is a three-arc-minute filter. And next I would say, well, now you have found a stellar overdensity. And I was talking to Beth last night who gave me these plots, and she pointed out that, in fact, these are false detections that you're seeing here. I decided to keep this up anyway because just to make the point that there are many false detections, and depending on what your threshold and what sort of filtering lights you're using, you can get a very different, two people can get a very different set of candidates depending on what these choices are. And so in understanding the completeness issues, it's very important to keep all of these sort of things in mind. But now going back to the image, and this is now for a real object. Here is the raw SDSF image. This is an image of Segway 1, which I'm going to sort of come back to several times during the rest of the talk. And what I've done next is just take stars that are in that filter region, that are around the isochrone, the best-fitting isochrone. And now you can perhaps see something that looks like a galaxy, where these stars are all just taken out of this object, or this image, to make this candidate-only stellar system. But this is not enough. Just looking at the stars here, we need to ask whether or not this is a bound object, what's its mass, what's its metallicity, and this is where follow-up spectroscopy comes in. So this is just looking at the Kalamanji diagram and taking stars that are just around the best-fitting isochrone in this region, and then making a fake image. This is Segway 1. I'll talk about this a lot more in detail. Okay, so now just talking about how we do the spectroscopy. So taking the image that you saw earlier, this is the color magnitude diagram again with the best fitting isochrone. This is again for Segway 1, although I'll talk about that in a second. This is a more general. So looking at the isochrone, you see the main sequence turn off, the horizontal branch. Ideally, what we would like is to get spectroscopy of stars, of all the stars that are close to the isochrone. Time is limited, and the instruments that we have we can't pack stars into an infinitely small area, and so we have to make certain choices, and so we have to prioritize what stars we'll actually find. And so this is for Keck Deimos spectroscopy, where we have a 16 arc minute multi-slit mask where we have to pack stars in appropriately, and so we pick stars, we have to prioritize. So we pick as many stars as we can very close to the isochrone, and then fill the rest of the mask in with things that are perhaps at lower priority. So again, there's a selection going into the things that we can actually get spectroscopy for. If we had more time, we would go and get more stars, but this is just reality. So for this object, we observe something like 50 stars to get velocities. And here's just the raw velocity histogram. So again, velocity on the x-axis, the histogram on the y. The foreground Milky Way is predicted to lie around 0 kilometers a second with a fairly broad distribution. But clearly we're seeing something that's not predicted just by the Milky Way population. And so if we color that in red, and then go back and look at where those stars lie on the isochrone, indeed all of the objects that we would call member stars lie very close to the isochrone. We have two horizontal branch stars and a red giant branch. So this seems to make some sense. So at this point, we say, we found something. And this indeed is Segway 1, which is the least luminous of these objects that have been found so far. Nicolas Martin's most recent update of the luminosity is minus 1.5, which is a total luminosity of about 350 solar luminosities. So, not finding many stars up here is consistent with its luminosity. If a single main sequence star decides to evolve up the giant branch, this is going to change its absolute luminosity, which is really quite remarkable. So let's look at this in a little bit more detail. So again, looking at the velocity histogram, you'll notice there's a couple of stars up at higher velocities. This object happens to lie in projection along the Sagittarius stream. And we tentatively, and I will come back to this, associate those stars with the Sagittarius stream. But let's not talk about those for a minute. Let's just focus in on Segway itself. Just to note, we call Segway 1, we do this in lowercase letters to differentiate this from the Segway survey. So I use the lowercase version of that word. So here we're plotting now the individual velocities as a function of radius, focusing in just on the histogram here. And you can see we've measured, we have membership for 24 objects. The gray region is the 1 sigma velocity dispersion. And so the velocity dispersion that we're just simply measuring, the effective radius, the half-light radius is 4 arc minutes, about 30 parsecs. So the velocity dispersion that we measure is 4.5 kilometers a second. And again, measuring this velocity dispersion depends crucially on whether or not we've measured our velocity errors or estimated our velocity errors. And we believe we've done this very carefully. I won't go into this here, but I'm very, very happy to talk about this afterwards. So we robustly measure a dispersion of about 4.5 kilometers a second based on these 24 stars. And so here's where things become interesting. So this is simply a measurement. If we take just the mass of the stars and assume that just from the mass of the stars that object is bound, we would have expected a dispersion of only about 0.4 kilometers a second. So clearly we're measuring something that's much, much larger and robustly measuring something that's much, much larger. So this is sort of the first indication that we need to go to something else besides just calling this a bound star cluster. And indeed, if we look at all the ultrafaints so far, the same thing is true in their velocity histograms. Here's the 8 ultrafaints coming from Simon and Jiha, but there's been for the other ones, there's been a lot more work by other authors as well. And indeed, in all these cases, we can color something red and clearly see an overdensity at velocities that you would not expect just coming from the Milky Way. There are cases where things are a little bit fuzzier, and so Ursa Major 2, you can see there's a lot of contamination and there's a lot of stuff going on in that region, and so you need to be very careful in terms of trying to pick out members, and it becomes more difficult when the systemic velocity of the dwarf happens to lie where most of the Milky Way stars are coming from. But in many cases, it's a very clean detection. Sure. So again, this is going through the membership counts. And so we can do a couple of different tests to figure out whether a star is associated with a dwarf or is a foreground star. And so there are a couple of spectroscopic diagnostics, such as surface gravity. There's a sodium 1 line. And we can tell whether or not it's a foreground star. And so some of these cases, Leo T in particular, is lying in a region where there's a lot of foreground stars. And we need to do this this membership cut. So in all cases so far that have been published, all these objects have a very clear velocity peak with widths somewhere between 3 and 8 kilometers a second. Okay, so now we have velocity dispersions, and now we have to interpret what those velocity dispersions mean. And so now we'll talk about how we estimate mass. There was a question on Monday. Again, these plots are all coming from Joe Wolf, and anything that has this color scheme is all coming from Joe. Looking at the total luminosity as a function of just the measured velocity dispersion. And so in all these plots, again, blue is going to be the old classical dwarf galaxies, and red is going to be the new ultra-faint dwarf galaxies. And indeed, the velocity dispersions are decreasing as you go to lower luminosities. So you can see the old satellites, the dispersions are somewhere between sort of 8 and 10, and as you go to the new ones, we're measuring something like 4 or 5. But we're measuring these at different stellar radius, right? So here we're measuring out to much larger radius than we're measuring here. And this will become an issue in the next slide. So just based on these velocity dispersions, we can do the simplest possible estimate for the mass. And if we just assume that this is a spherical, in dynamical equilibrium, a bound system, isotropic velocity dispersions, and that mass follows light, we can measure a mass. All of these four assumptions can and possibly are wrong. So clearly, some of these are not spherical. The question of dynamical equilibrium is crucial, and I'll spend a couple of slides on that in a few minutes. The last two points, isotropic velocity dispersions and light traces mass, will loosen in the next slide. But just going on the simplest possible assumptions, the total mass, in this case, if mass follows light, is proportional to the dispersion you're measuring times some sort of core radius. And for these objects, we are measuring masses that indeed do decrease as a function of the total luminosity. But we know that mass does not follow light. We can prove that mass does not follow light. That's just looking at the velocity dispersions as a function of radius. And so for the classical dwarfs, this is sort of a famous picture now from Matt Walker, looking at velocities of thousands of stars in these objects. And just focusing in on Fornax, I suppose I like it too. The dotted line is what you would expect if mass follows light. And clearly the velocities are not following mass follows light. That is, they are staying flat as a function of radius as the light is falling off. And that's true in all of these cases. It's also true in the ultrafaints, where here's again as a function of radius away from the center of the object, the velocity, the red I've just plotted, the half-light radius in these four objects that I've picked out. And the white is just all of our individual velocity measurements. And you can see again, in the best measured cases, The velocities do not seem to be falling off as you would expect if the light following the light distribution. Clearly, in some cases, CVN1, we have over 200 stars. In other cases, we have far fewer. We'd like to get more, but I think in all cases, we're able to measure measure fairly robustly the masses. Okay, so if mass is not following light, let's talk about measuring the mass in a little bit more sophisticated way. So this is by Louis Strigari, and again, we've talked about this a little bit in previous talks. Louis is using all of the individual velocities, and this is in contrast to using just the central velocity dispersion. And he assumes that mass doesn't follow light, that the mass and light have different density profiles. And so in his models, which I believe James will talk about in more detail tomorrow, the light is following a King profile and doesn't really contribute much to the total mass mass budget. And the mass is following essentially an FW profile, but with five free parameters, where the central velocity or the central density slope is allowed to change, the anisotropy is allowed to change. And what he does is marginalizes over those five free parameters using the individual velocity measurements. And we've seen this plot now. So if you do that for all of the ultrafaints and all of the classical dwarfs, and so using the same modeling for all of the objects that we've observed so far, and you measure the mass within a given radius, so now within a given fixed physical radius of right now 300 parsecs, what he's finding is that the luminosity is changing by five orders of magnitude, but the total masses are staying relatively the same within this fixed given mass. So for each of these objects, he's marginalizing over the various density profiles. But, yeah, Hans Walter.
Just a quick question for Segway 1. Mm-hmm. The reference radius of 300 parsecs is how much larger than the radius of the last actually measured kinematic tracer?
Sure. So I'll talk about the tidal radius and stuff specifically for Segway. It's the last measured velocity is at about 50 to 60 parsecs. So we are going much farther than the light distribution. So in the case is sort of on this side of the plot, we are extending the profile beyond the last measured point. In these cases, we are stopping before the last measured point. And it's sort of hard to get around that if you want to sort of measure, compare apples and apples and that sort of thing. Mass and velocity dispersion? What do you mean? Right. Well, here, let me go through these two plots, and then you can ask me the same question. So we have the fits for these objects. We can then plot, for example, the mass within the stellar extent as a function of luminosity, which I think is closer to what you're asking. And of course, because we're measuring at different velocities or different radii, the mass within the stellar extent does decrease as you go to lower and lower stellar masses. But again, even if we just do the mass within the stellar extent, the mass to light ratios are still increasing as we go to lower luminosities. And if we use the mass within 300 parsecs, that would simply increase the slope of the mass to light ratio. So here we're plotting mass to light ratio as a function of total luminosity, where the mass to light ratios are now increasing to things like 100 and 1,000 down at the lowest luminosity, Segway 1. So let's just apply this in a single... is that true? Oh. Okay, I'll go a little bit faster. Let's apply this to Segway 1, again, assuming that this is a bound object. So here we've measured a velocity dispersion of 4.5. If we measure a mass within the last measured radius, so within about 50 parsecs, we get a mass that's about 10 to the 6th total mass. If we extend that out to 300 parsecs, and you can argue whether or not you want to do that, we get something like 10 to the 7th. If you compare this now to the mass in stars with a total luminosity of 350 solar luminosities, you'd expect the mass in stars to be something like 1,000. And so you can simply do the mass to light ratio there using the more conservative mass within 50 parsecs. We're getting a mass to light ratio of something like 2,000. Just to note, the error bars here are not linear in mass to light ratio. So, for example, you can't get the 2 sigma value by multiplying this by 2. the errors are actually linear in the log of the mass to light ratio. And so this is actually a several sigma detection of dark matter dominated in this object.
Oh, that's not the mass to light ratio inside
8 divided 8 to the fifth times divided by 10 to the third? No. Right, so that's the mass in stars, the luminosity. It's the mass to light ratio. Right, so that would make segue the least luminous, most dark matter dominated galaxy known. You can hear the press bells going off. However, the mass estimates, and this is true for segue and all of the ultra faints and all of the classical dwarfs, rest entirely on the assumption that the measured stars are gravitationally bound and are in dynamical equilibrium. That is, the velocities are faithfully tracing the potential of the dwarf itself and that there's nothing else going on. And so we really need to sit down and look at evidence for any sort of ongoing tidal disruption. And again, I put ongoing in italics because if there's been past tidal disruption or something like that, we're still measuring the mass presently. And so we assume that the things have come back into dynamical equilibrium. We're only concerned about ongoing tidal disruption that would currently screw up our masses now. And so let's look for that sort of evidence. And again, I'll do this specifically for Segway, and then I'll look at this in a little bit more general. So now looking at Segway in terms of any sort of evidence for tidal interactions, the distance from Segway to the galactic center is 28 kiloparsecs. Its galactic-centric velocity is about 100 kilometers a second, and so depending on the proper motions, presumably it is moving away from the galaxy at this time. And so we can ask two questions. First, we can ask, are the stars in Segway currently disrupting? That is, are any of these objects not bound or have been are not feeling the tidal interaction, or are feeling the tidal interaction, the tidal forces from the Milky Way? And another question to ask is whether or not this object is completely unbound. That is, do the velocities really not tell us anything about the gravitational potential in this area? And so at this point, I just put on a quick sign that this is all hand waving. I will turn this sign off and you can come back if this bothers you. So assuming that the mass we've measured using Louis' method is correct, we would measure, both mass to light ratio and Louis' method, we measure a tidal radius of something like 200 parsecs or perhaps even as large as 600 parsecs. And so with the effective radius being at about 30 parsecs, just based on this calculation, we would think that perhaps the stars are not feeling that are what's sufficiently embedded within a dark matter halo to not be feeling tighter forces. Yeah, so it's an instantaneous tidal, and this is using the Jacobi radius and that sort of thing. In the past, so certainly this is an instantaneous tidal radius now. So the tidal, you know, the tidal radius combined with the fact that we don't see any velocity outliers. We don't see any velocity outliers. That is, all the stars that we're measuring are within 2.5 sigma of the mean velocity. That suggests to us, at least, that the stars currently are not being influenced by tides. That does not mean it is currently not being influenced by tides. We just don't see any evidence for the contrary. And then the question of whether or not this is a completely unbound system. We can measure sort of we can estimate the crossing time, which is about 10 to the 7th years. Given just the velocity of Segway today, it means that it would move about a kiloparsec in one crossing time. And so, again, this is really hand-waving. Within one kiloparsec, the Milky Way potential is not changing all that much. And so if the site of disruption, of completely disrupting this, is farther away, we would have expected Segway 1 to have dissolved at this time. And again, this is not evidence that it is not. It's just sort of a hand-wavy argument that this seems to be unlikely. However, there's a poster outside who they're finding tidal debris much, much farther away from Segway 1 and associating with that, saying that this may in fact be a disrupted cluster. And I think the jury is out there and we really need to get velocities in those areas to be able to say much more. Okay, one more point, really quick. I want to talk about the ellipticities, and so looking at the ellipticities of these objects as a function of luminosity. It was pointed out by Hans Walter, and this is actually a discussion we were having in coffee a couple weeks ago. As a function of total luminosity, the ellipticities, that is how elongated these objects are, seems to increase as you go to lower luminosities. And so this was suggested as evidence that maybe the lower luminosity objects are feeling more tidal disruptions and are getting more elongated. So the real question is whether this is intrinsic or tidal, which I think is an interesting question. Sagittarius is actually farther out in total luminosity, not clear exactly where to put it, but is very elliptical, and we know that is a case where things are tidally disrupting. So a plot Joe Wolf plotted the ellipticity as a function of the galactocentric velocity. So you would expect that if something is at apogalacticon or peri, the velocity would be close to zero, and you would see most of the things that are highly elliptical falling sort of right in this region. And so there is one case where that you know, you might be able to argue that direction. That's Ursa Major 1. Hercules, which we were arguing about yesterday, is over here. It's still highly elliptical, but it's at a fairly large galactocentric velocity. So I don't think this argument will necessarily work for all the ultrafaints, but you know, it may be working for a couple of them. And again, you can also plot this as a function of galactocentric distance. And so at least this seems to argue to me that that the ellipticities may in fact be more of an intrinsic property to the ultrafaints rather than something that's of tidal origin. I'll skip. Okay. I just want to, one more last plot. We can now plot the luminosity, the mass to light ratio, but we can also plot the metallicities. And we see that the metallicities are also correlated with luminosities and that the lowest metallicity objects are also the least luminous. And so at this point, I can then throw the baton to Josh, who will be talking about this in a lot more detail after coffee. Sorry, I'm missing Wilman. So just in summary, the ultrafaints really are extreme in every sense of the word, and I'll leave you with a Google search that I found particularly amusing.
Hey, so I just wanted to agree with you, I like agreeing, about the ellipticities in the sense that if you run a simulation of a spherical satellite and try and disrupt it, it only becomes extremely elliptical at the point where it's completely unbound. So for Sagittarius, we're pretty sure it's bound. So unless you don't want to say that, well, maybe you do. I would want to say that they're all completely unbound and on the verge of disruption. So I would say that ellipticities are likely to be intrinsic, mostly.
Well, I don't really see the issue of having a few of them unbound, actually. Because,
so I agree. I think you can argue for a few cases. I don't think you can argue in all cases where you see high ellipticity, some sort of tidal origin from that.
So you actually have two or three of them out of 13 that are very elliptical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, you know, 20%, 30%.
Well, but there's only one that is at the point in its radius that you would expect it.
So could you get back to your argument with the real velocity? I didn't quite get that. The one you just passed, actually.
Yep. Sorry. This.
Yeah.
Can you just restate the argument, Marla?
Oh, I mean, so the point where you expect the most tidal interaction, you expect the stars to be most affected by tidal interaction as it's going around its orbit, is the point of apo or peri. And there you would expect the velocity relative to the galactic center to be closest to zero.
Right, but at apocenter, this is also where we have all the stars piling up to the system. Again.
Well, at this point, I would defer to Catherine. I mean, in her models, in Julio's models, you see the most ellipticity in the stellar distribution at the point of apo or peri.
Let's chat about that afterwards.
So, let me make just one extra comment on that. The sign of a tidal interaction will only last as long as a local crossing time.
Agreed.
If you're in eccentric orbit, in which case, you know, most of the action onto the galaxy is impulsive at the pericenter. So you have to wait until you pass pericenter. It will last for a little longer. And if you're apocenter, you probably will see nothing because basically the effect of the tidal has already dissipated and moved out. So my question was, I want to see what happens with Wilman 1. I'll defer to the chairwoman here.
So the issue with Wilman 1, Wilman 1 has two issues. The first is that this is the velocity histogram. This isn't quite what I want to show, but it's well within where we expect the Milky Way stars. And so there's an enormous amount of contamination. And so it's difficult to decide which star is a star of Willman and which one is not. If you do that somewhat carefully, and Beth has done this is a data set she's been working on a lot. Using a whole bunch of different diagnostics. The metallicity as well is one of the diagnostics. So this is the velocity as a function of distance from the center of Willman that you see, where the red objects are Willman 1 members. The blue are things that have been thrown out based on metallicity. And what you can see, it's kind of odd, most of the stars that are closest to Willman 1, closest to the center, are at a certain velocity, and then the rest are kind of stepped down or at a different velocity. And so it kinematically seems to be really kind of a strange object. And we're sort of working on interpretation of what that means.
Louis looked into this, and he has not. Well,
So the intrinsic ellipticity, if it is intrinsic, is it supposed to reflect the shape of the dark matter potential itself? I mean, because you don't really expect that to be spherical either.
I think this is something we've just started thinking about this week. It'd be interesting to see if you can set up, you know, what kind of elliptical stellar distributions you can set up in what sort of dark matter halo. Why doesn't the radial distribution follow dark matter? Do you have models that I can see? Okay.
I had a question on your argument about the tides on Segway 1. Isn't there a bit of a circular argument when you derive the tidal radius of the object based on the mass that you...
Yeah, it is absolutely it's circular. I'm not sure what else.
Okay.
You know, we're trying to do what we can. But it's, you know, it's tough without more data.
Yeah. And the other question is, I didn't quite understand how you got that. How you made the conclusion that it would be this, you wouldn't be able to see it by now. If you have a velocity dispersion of 5 kilometers a second, that's about 5 kiloparsec per gigayear. So it doesn't sound like it would be completely disrupted, right? It would be.
So I mean, the crossing time is fairly short.
Yeah.
Sort of a very naive, you know, interpretation. The crossing time, I would think that things would dissolve quickly. It's not clear to me if you have something that's unbound on a, you know, everything on the same orbit, whether or not you could see it, you know, at a certain point. But the distribution of light is centrally concentrated, so it sort of seems like you have to do quite a lot to get that kind of distribution. That's an unbound system.
Yeah, but I think the argument on the crossing time is probably not valid. What you want to calculate the time scale is really the relative velocities of the stars to be able to tell whether there would be an overdensity or not. And that's given by the velocity dispersion, which is this 5 kilometers a second or 5 kiloparsecs per gigayear.
I wanted to get back to make a comment on the early part of your talk in defense of algorithmic searches for satellites, just because you showed an allegedly false detection. I think it is possible when, you know, for example, when Sergei Kapasov looked at this, you can actually devise an algorithmic search for these satellites that nearly perfectly finds all known objects without false detections. I think that's also true for the Walsh et al.
Absolutely, we don't disagree with you.
And the contaminant, right, just to, is much of it is in
right,
galaxies.
Right, and so the point there was that you really need to set the detection thresholds and sizes very well to get rid of those false detections.
The point is that a 3-sigma detection isn't a statistically significant detection, for example. And I'm sure Sergei also had to be very careful with how he set his threshold to not let in a lot of non-significant detections.
That is indeed true. I mean, the biggest contaminant are galaxies that are unresolved, so you need to reject peaks that are
exactly.
And I think as we were talking last night,
as you get to lower, pushing the magnitudes deeper and deeper to try and find objects farther and farther away, galaxy star separation is going to become the major issue in trying to find new dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way.
And even beyond the galaxy contamination, right? We're analyzing millions of false pixels, and the distribution of surface densities isn't really Gaussian. So those are other reasons you have to be rather careful.
Couple of years. What else? You exhausted the Sloan
In the Walsh paper, there are 13 viable candidates that have not yet been followed up. But that's really starting to scoop the bottom of the barrel, I think, for Sloan. And then we're talking about the new large surveys. So SkyMapper and PanSTARRS, I think, seem to me at least the next two big surveys that are on the horizon. You know, and then LSST and beyond.
Hans-Walter, quick response to that. I can see you're dying in the car.
No. I just want to comment on that if you dig deeper on the candidate list, I think both Walshalal and Sergey has found that you very rapidly seem to run into either practically or conceptually false detections. Many of those things seem to be just little overdensities and knobs in otherwise known tidal streams. That's the next thing you pick up. So I think once you dig deeper, you really run into that mess. So I think by area, you know, PanSTARRS and the SkyMapper will do things, but going further away will be very hard.
And it's also hard. I mean, most of these galaxies that we found so far are sort of 20 to 40 to 50 stars. And you need to get that many members to really say this is an object. And it's getting harder as you go to things that are intrinsically fainter.
The issue of completeness, you know, you want to extrapolate and say how much are we missing. I remember from many detailed talks by the MACHO team how difficult it was for them to come to their conclusion about whether they were or were not seeing this missing Hadron baryons. The same for you. I mean, does your selection function take into account the proximity to bright stars, galaxies, the velocity field of the galaxy, and how detailed is your selection function?
I will not answer that. There's a poster outside, Eric Toller, and it's really done that well. And James is going to have, he has slides tomorrow that specifically.
So this number you quoted, 63,
Based on just doing Sloan across the whole sky.
Right. But that takes into account all those selection issues.
No, it does. It doesn't take into account the selection issues in terms of digging deeper. The sky. So that's just sky coverage.
Sky coverage. But for example, my question is an awful lot of sky near bright sources.
That's literally multiplying by four. So no, it's not including the fact that you're not going to be able to find things close to the galactic plane. The LMC SMC will get rid of a lot of area as well. Right, and that's where the 400 number comes in. It's just assuming that you'd find those faint things in the full volume of the Milky Way. And that's where the number 400 or 500 is getting tossed
around. My question is, how many could there be?
400 or 500.
That would be...
Yeah.
Just a very quick question. Can you comment on two related things? Recently, Wynne Evans said to me that the limiting factor now in estimating the masses is no longer the velocity, the spectroscopy, but the photometry, and that the main uncertainties are actually coming from just understanding the surface brightness. And then a related question is, there was a discussion about this the other day from the floor, but what are the limits on the systemic rotation that you can get for all these objects?
Okay, so for the first question, I think that the limits in measuring the mass is still velocity, that we need to get more velocity members. Right now, in terms of spectroscopy, we can't even get to the Sloan limit, R of 23. That's about 3 or 4 hours at Keck. So we're just barely getting to the Sloan limit. So in terms of measuring the masses, it's a velocity issue still. We certainly can get much deeper photometry, and that somehow, for some reason, is lagging behind some of the velocity work.
It's not the sexy, I guess. Well, and even the, you know, run with radius, of surface brightness with radius. It wasn't my comment, it was Wynne Evans who said this to me.
And I've totally forgot your second question.
So the second question is, what are the limits on systemic rotation?
So in terms of Segway, which we have 24 stars, the limits on rotation are about 5 kilometers a second. If it was less than that, we would not see that sort of rotation. And that's the limits are pretty close to the same for the rest of the ultra faints.
Thanks.
So thanks again to both our speakers, and let's have a cup of tea.